From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, one beloved barbecue joint in Detroit on surviving the pandemic.
I'm not going to lie to you. It's a lot of hard work. It's a lot of long hours, but it's well worth it when you see smiles on people's faces.
And we'll check in with two writers in Detroit putting together a special fiction and poetry edition for the Detroit Metro Times.
I know it gets said all the time that Detroit's creative commonwealth is vibrant and thriving and rich, and all the other adjectives that, while true, have become cliche from hollow overuse. There is, however, one word that can't be said enough. Detroit's arts community is essential.
Then award-winning poet Tommy Blount reflects on exploring the nuances of love and pain for Black Americans.
It is concerned with all of these individuals that are sort of wrestling with the narratives around their bodies and their selfhood.
Those stories and more just ahead. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. On today's show, we talk with one of the finest writers in Detroit about chronicling the city through creative writing.
When I'm writing, I'm drafting it so that that person that's on the page is alien to me, yet it is me, right?
That's coming up later. But first, we're not going to lie. Our heads are kind of already into Memorial Day weekend. Things we'll do with our families, people we'll get to see, and most of all, stuff we're going to grill. This is a weekend when many Michiganders are ready to level up their grill game. We thought it best to check in with one of the pros, and also a business much beloved by Detroiters, which has managed to hang on throughout the pandemic. J. Lee Deering joins us now. He is the manager of Burt's Marketplace, the legendary barbecue and music joint in the Eastern Market, serving up everything from a devastating fried chicken named after the Queen of Soul to ribs from the smoker. J. Lee, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
Now that the restrictions are slowly lifting and people are starting to feel a little bit more comfortable being vaccinated, going out and about, how's business been at Burt's?
Business is really good. We see a lot more traffic. We see waves of traffic coming in that we have a lot of new customers. People just are happy to be out. People know that Burt's is an institution here in Detroit, especially in Eastern Market. We've been here at this location for over 34 years, been in business over 54 years. So they know it's a safe place to come. They know it's a comfortable place to come. And they know it's a place you can come and always have a good time, always have great food.
Yeah.
So the combination of those things and just knowing that we're old faithfuls and old reliables, it makes it a good time for everyone involved.
So much of the experience of your place is the vibe, the music, the incredible, wonderful smells going all throughout the place and through the market. Has much of that changed?
No. I mean, like I said, we've got a lot of new people. I'm amazed to see that. I thought everybody knew about Burt's, but obviously they didn't. We've got a lot of new millennials. Like, this is their home base now. So that's encouraging. The cool thing is we've been able to relate or go across the generations to different people.
Right. Is Memorial Day weekend a big one for you? Usually people take the long weekend to get together, maybe go out.
Well, it tends to be. You got a lot of people leaving town, but you got a lot of people coming in town also. And I've seen they're going to cook for the family, and they're at the meat market, the butcher slaughterhouse, picking up ribs, picking up chicken, and then they walk by us and smell the meat, and they come and buy some, they taste the meat, and they say, you know what, we're going to throw this stuff in the freezer, and we're going to buy 7-8 slabs from this guy, and let's just drink some beers, and rather cook, and let's enjoy ourselves. I can't tell you how many times that has happened. So we load up pretty good. We're preparing now, you know, getting prepped and getting ready so we can handle the crowds, handle those folks that just, you know, let us do the cooking for them.
Right. And why wait? Why wait when you can just get right into it? What do you recommend on the menu this weekend?
Definitely ribs. Ribs and chicken. You can't go wrong.
For sure.
We're going to be locked and loaded and ready to go. Our team is motivated, and we're waiting on the crowds. So we can get the weather cooperate. I think it's going to be a great weekend.
What have been some of your most popular orders during the past year?
So Burt's sits in a complex, two city blocks almost. So we have several storefronts. So on one end, you have Burt's Jazz Club, the traditional where we initially started. Next door to that, we've got, which has been open for about 2 months now, we've got Mr. B's Pizza and Wings. It's the gangster pizza. So we've got a gangster-themed pizza restaurant, wing restaurant, and the pizza's to die for. Literally is to die for, if you know what I mean. And so then next door to that, we've got a seafood, upscale seafood steak and pasta restaurant called the Motown Bistro, which is amazing. We won restaurant of the year 2019, right before the pandemic hit. And then our warehouse theater in the back, we pivoted and we made that into a comedy club theater. So now Burt's Warehouse Theater is Burt's Comedy Club.
Jay, I can't believe you've been able to keep all this going.
Oh, you know, hey, desperation makes you do desperate things. So we had to reinvent ourselves. We've had to pivot. We're just glad to still be here, and we're thankful that the community and the trade as a whole has supported us. You know, we could not have done it without them. We've seen so many restaurants, so many institutions close. Places that, you know, you were just like, wow, these are the places you want to be. They've closed and shut their doors. God's been good to us, and he's given us the strength and the motivation to figure out how to pivot and continue to keep our doors open. And I'm not going to lie to you. It's a lot of hard work. It's a lot of long hours, but it's well worth it when you see smiles on people's faces.
Jay, a question for the home cooks who are listening. Some of us may be a little bit rusty cooking for the crowd.
I got you.
And might have some plans with family this weekend. Do you have any pointers about timing everything out?
Well, you know, I wish you were standing here with me right now. The fire is just hitting the open just right now. The cherry wood is hitting it just right now. Jump in there, get those side items prepped in the oven, get the seasoning in, and let them sit. And then it's just an issue of really putting them in the oven and pulling them out in a matter of, you know, 20, 30 minutes, depending on what you're having. So it's not always warrant the side of getting it done early and getting it done fast. Put them on your schedule. Don't stress out. Get you a good libation. That helps.
Right. Jay Lee Deering is the manager of Burt's Marketplace, legendary barbecue and music joint in the Eastern Market, and at the center, as he told us, of a whole complex of businesses. Jay, great talking to you. Good luck this weekend.
Thank you. God bless.
Well, like the man said, have an appropriate beverage at hand this weekend. To that end, Michigan Radio's Lester Graham and mixologist Tammy Coxon are back, and they've got the perfect festive drink for your holiday weekend. Here's their latest edition of Cheers.
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 Hi, Lester.
Hi, Tammy. That's Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tastings. I'm Lester Graham with Michigan Radio, and we're here to talk about another cocktail. And you know, it's summer when you see Bell's Oberon hit your local grocer, because that's kind of a summer ritual anymore in Michigan. But you're making a cocktail. We're not just going to sip an Oberon, right?
That's right. And this is not our first Oberon cocktail.
I remembered the other one. It was really good. Yeah.
And it made my hands very famous because we had that overhead video that people could watch of it being assembled. And it got watched some ridiculous number of times.
I have famous hands, she says. Okay. Well, what do we do differently this time with this cocktail compared to the last one?
So this is a riff on a classic cocktail called the Bee's Knees. So this is one of the most famous cocktails to come out of Prohibition. We all know the Prohibition story. The booze was bad, bad, bad. And so when you were using it, you would try to cover it up by having strongly flavored ingredients in your cocktail. So this is just a riff on a gin sour. Think about a whiskey sour, right? So it would have been gin, simple syrup, and lemon juice. But because you wanted to cover up the taste of the bad gin, a Bee's Knees used honey syrup instead of simple syrup.
Okay, that makes sense. A little more flavor there, a little more covering up the bad booze, as you say.
That's right. And so
But you're not using bad booze this time, right?
No, I'm using very good booze, actually. But so to make it a beer's knees, we're just going to top it off with some beer.
Ah, okay. A beer's knees. Cute. I saw you had Michigan honey. Good for you. But you've got a Michigan spirit here, too, as well as the Oberon Ale.
Yeah, this is one of my newest gin discoveries. This is the barrel-finished Peninsula Gin from Grand Traverse Distillery.
What do they do with their gin?
So I don't actually know a lot about the basic gin, but this is their barrel-finished version of it. We've talked about Grand Traverse before. We tasted their rye whiskey a while back and really loved that. So this is finished in their bourbon and rye whiskey barrels after have used them. And it's just really interesting. This is going to sound like totally weird, but imagine a really nice oak table that's been varnished with lemon pledge, but in the best possible way.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's something I have to... Oh, you poured a little sample here. Okay. Smells like gin.
Right. Juniper definitely on the nose.
Wow.
Do you see what I mean? Like, it's distinctly lemony.
Oh, yeah.
And then you get that oak flavor, but it's just so easy and smooth to drink on its own.
It really is. It's kind of that oak and lemon.
Lemon oil.
Lemon oil.
Lemon oil. So we, right, we polish the table with lemon oil. How's that?
That's super. That's a better description.
Okay.
No offense to the people who make lemon pledge, you know, but.
Right. So to make the beer's knees, 2 ounces of gin, doesn't have to be this one, any gin's gonna be great here. 1/2 ounce of lemon juice, 1/2 ounce of honey syrup. So that's not just straight honey, because that would just clump up with the ice, but instead it's 2 parts honey that's been mixed with 1 part hot water, just to loosen it up a little bit. And then you take that, put it in your cocktail shaker, shake it up really well, strain it into a glass, and top it off with about 1 ounce, 1.5 ounces of Oberon or another beer of your choice. This is also great with an IPA.
And you used a garnish of not just orange peel, but a wedge.
Right, just like you would put in your glass of Oberon when you were drinking it, as is the traditional Michigan way. But I always like an orange wedge in my bee's knees as well. So that's part of what made me think, Oberon would be a good beer to use in a beer's knees, because it would come together that way.
And you did give it a little squeeze too. You didn't just pop it.
Oh, that's right. You absolutely want that orange juice in there for sure. And you might want to use a slightly bigger glass than I did, because I had to do that little slurp before I lifted it off the table, because this one definitely filled up.
Well, I'm going to take a taste, and I'm thinking of that Oberon Sour that you made some time ago. It's been, 3-4 years ago, probably.
I think so.
And I still remember how good that was.
It was good, and this is good in a similar but different way.
It's a completely different drink than the previous drink. That oak finish, that rye bourbon oak finish on that gin really gives this drink some presence. You know you're drinking something special because it's sending all kinds of messages to your tongue that, hey, try to figure this one out.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. The first thing I get is the beer. I'm like, oh yeah, it's the beer cocktail. And then the gin comes in on the finish and you get that, oh yep, that's that gin that I really like.
Actually, I kind of had the reverse. I got that oaky taste first, the very first thing I got. And then the rest of it was that nice blend of the gin and the ale, the Oberon. No matter how you take it, that's a really nice drink, a really fine drink. Is this your adaptation, or did you discover this somewhere?
I think this drink is one of those parallel evolutions. It's floating around the internet from a whole lot of different sources, and I've used it with lots of different beers and lots of different gins.
But not necessarily with barrel-finished gin. That's
no, this definitely takes it to a new level.
Yeah, I like it. Well, cheers.
Cheers.
Coming up, we speak with the editors of a special fiction and poetry edition of Detroit's Metro Times.
Detroit's arts community is essential.
We'll be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The annual fiction and poetry edition of the Detroit Metro Times. It once again features incredible work by local writers and artists who contribute to such a rich creative culture in the city. With us today are the two editors and curators of this edition, who are both also very gifted in their own right, Drew Philp and Nandi Comer. Drew, Nandi, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
You know, I've been waiting to see what artists across all disciplines have been doing during the pandemic, to the extent that people have had freedom to work. I just wanted to know what you've both been hearing from writers you know, and what writing has been like during this time. Nandi, could you start us out? I mean, has your process been sort of going forward through all this, or are you just working in different ways?
Oh, work for me has been quite changed. So much of my work beforehand was about being outside of the house and experiencing the world outside of home. And it's really turned internally for me. It's really been some domestic work, domestic kind of descriptions, but also we went through what is likely the most traumatizing year that we'll experience in our generation. And so it's been really reflecting on the crisis, not only the health crisis, but the racial injustices that we've seen through this time that has really just emerged and been highlighted by us being home and not having anywhere but the social media and TV to have to understand what's going on in the world. So my writing has been reflective of that, but also just my own personal experiences and just going through my own life events like we all do as writers, I don't say that it's necessarily hopeful nor sad. It's all of that. It's all the things that we've been experiencing through this time.
For sure. Drew, what about you? I mean, has it just been difficult to put pen to page or go to the computer and get things done?
So for me, it's been pretty much the same. I'm a real workhorse. So I kind of escape into work a lot. Although I write mostly nonfiction, and the fiction and the plays and the films and things I write are always very, very grounded in the world. So for me, it's been a kind of good place to get away from the social media and to have to focus so intently on one thing has been very healthy for me. I've got some exciting new projects coming up. I was able to write the first draft of a novel last summer, and I'm working on a play actually that came out of last year's fiction issue with the head of the founder and artistic director of Shakespeare in Detroit, Samantha White. So I'm pretty excited about those things.
There are a number of miraculous things about this Metro Times fiction issue, but not the least of them is the representation of who's here. There are many different names here that people will know, people who are known nationally, like Tommy Blunt and Adrienne Marie Brown, and also some bylines that people may know from different kinds of writing who are trying different things. But And then some emerging folks as well. Was it important to you two as you were curating this issue to show that full breadth?
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. I think that, there's this, we need more representation in Detroit media, very frankly. One of our artists last year, Aaron Foley, has been talking about this for years. And I think that we really strive to make this representative of our community in many, many different ways. One of those is having poets and writers and artists in different stages of their careers. So it's really nice to be able to put younger artists or artists who are trying something new next to someone like Danielle McGill or Tommy Blount, who are these, world-class poets. And I think that's important, but it's also important that we kind of get all these voices from our community, and I really mean all of our community. We try very hard to have all kinds of diversity within race, gender, sexual orientation, but also kind of some of these lesser known things or things that aren't talked about as much, like geographical location and things like that. So absolutely, we really, really want to represent our community in a big way.
Yeah. Nandi, were you surprised at all to see the kinds of things that people were writing about?
Yes. I mean, we initially did the invite. We have the theme of connection. And so while that's a broad kind of stroke of a theme, it really was surprising to see how connected the writing was, in a sense. So we have writers that are writing about a lot of different topics, but we still have writers that seem to be experiencing and reflecting on a lot of the same themes under that large umbrella of connection. So I really did, was really surprised by someone like Mars writing in their poetry, and then seeing that same kind of theme showing up in Dunya's work, for example. So I was really happy to see the different ideas coming out.
Drew, I wanted to ask you to read a little bit from your preface to the issue about what it's been such a strange year for artists, in part because people had so many essential needs that were going unmet. And yet I think a lot of us do feel that the arts are an essential. And you kind of riffed on that in the preface. Can you read a bit for us?
Sure. Excuse me. Listen, I know it gets said all the time that Detroit's creative commonwealth is vibrant and thriving and rich, and all the other adjectives that, while true, have become cliche from hollow overuse. There is, however, one word that can't be said enough. Detroit's arts community is essential. Detroit's arts community is not essential because it buoys the economy or makes Detroit welcoming and desirable to outsiders or brightens the walls of our city with pleasant decoration. It does do all those things, which are important. But those positives don't rise to the same significance as a bus driver shepherding people to work or a farmer keeping food on our tables. Where it does, why Detroit's arts community is essential, is because the act of imagination is the first step in creating a new world. It seems almost too obvious to state, but so simple as to be frequently missed. If we're unable to first envision a new way to live, we will be unable to create one. Artists are professional imaginers, and art, especially in Detroit, is not simply agreeable window dressing to a city and culture. It is the initial act of creating a new, better world, and this year has shown us how desperately we need one.
My guests today are Drew Philp and Nandi Comer. They work together to edit the most recent edition of the Metro Times. It's a fiction issue. What you wrote, Drew, it feels so beautiful and kind of so very much of Detroit to acknowledge the work in that kind of way.
Oh, thank you. You know, that's an idea. So this idea that kind of we need art to kind of imagine a new world. It's why the reason we have art classes and music classes in school, because we have to be able to imagine in a democracy to kind of create what comes next is an idea that came from Grace Lee Boggs. That's not my original idea, of course. I'm sure it wasn't necessarily Grace's either. I think that's a very common view. That's very, very Detroit. And I think it's very important. And I think it's really important why the arts remain essential in our schools, in our communities, and projects like this that we put money into the arts, not because it's, you know, like this fine kind of like nice thing to do. It's absolutely not extra. We absolutely have to have these professional imaginers to be able to create that new world we're looking for. We have to be able to envision it first. So I think our artists are really on the spear tip, on the vanguard of what comes after this kind of profound sorrow of this year. And I feel very strongly about that.
Nandi, I wanted to ask you about a truly extraordinary work that's included in this issue. There are several examples of visual art that were chosen to go with this, but there's a piece by Scheherazade Washington Parrish that kind of functions as both visual art and written word. Could you describe it for folks?
Oh, yeah. It is, so I've seen it in person. It's a very large piece. It has a background. It's completely in black. And then there is this saturation of words that start off March 13th, 2020, and there are entries for March, the month of March, which seems to go on and on like the words on this canvas, and they just go on until we reach the date of March 396th. And you kind of feel like even at that moment, it still keeps going on. There are journal entries of different events that are happening throughout this whole time of what is this extended month of March for the author.
Yeah. I know this is hard, but can you choose a few lines of hers to read to us?
Sure. I'll read a couple of entries. Start off March 23rd, 2020. There is no Lysol spray anywhere. I brought plenty of bleach. There are no masks available. I cut a sock and put a menstrual pad on it and tied it around my mouth. This is my protection. March 24th, 2020. I have bleached myself 5 times today. March 55th, 2020. White folk are protesting wearing masks and sheltering in place because they need their hair done and their teeth cleaned and roots bleached and nails done. March 58th. 2020. If you know Trump wasn't talking about Lysol when he said disinfectant, then you know Kaepernick wasn't protesting the military when he kneeled.
Man, that is so evocative of the terror that I think we were all feeling in the early days and the obsessive thoughts that came to all of us in lockdown and the monotony and just like it's such a perfect expression of the too much that people were experiencing.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that this piece does so much to not only reflect on the last year and remind us of the kind of struggles and obstacles that we've been facing, but it also underlines the issues that are continuing. So even though we get to that end, that 396th day, you have this feeling that it's just, we're still running through it. It's still happening. And we don't know when we're actually going to come out of this.
Was it a lot to edit these works?
It is a lot of work. It is. I think everybody involved in this has worked really hard, tirelessly in some cases. And however, that's really balanced out by, I think, the benefit that we get in our community. You know, this reaches hundreds of thousands of people. We're able to pay, you know, now at this point, more than 40 artists pretty well for these pieces and keep people going. I know this is, you know, we're able to pay a rent payment for some folks. And, you know, this is really just a home run for everybody involved, for the Metro Times, for Kresge Arts in Detroit, for our readers, for the writers. So I think it's a small price to pay for what kind of our community gets out of something like this. You know, before this, you know, to the best of my knowledge, there wasn't a real kind of like widely available free yearly kind of showcase for like writing, flat writing, that's not spoken. So this is so it's 100% worth it. This is something I'm very proud of, and I think it's a net positive to basically everyone in our community.
Nandi, not everybody was spilling out their most difficult moments of the past year in these works of fiction. There are some things that definitely have a lighter feel to them, and some people aren't even writing about COVID or what was happening in the streets. There's a real range. Did you find it difficult to try to filter or at least take a critical eye to the things that people were bringing to the page?
The writers that are included in here are just brought such excellent work to the page. I felt like it was not difficult in terms of receiving the pieces, reviewing them. I mean, the kind of suggestions that we had were not in a sense of like that kind of editing down and revisioning, because they really brought this like first class level of writing to the project. I was very just, it made so much sense when a writer submitted their work. You have somebody like Imani Mixon writing about Tina Turner in a way that's just so lush that there was no way that we would, there's nothing we could do with that piece. It was perfect the way it came in. So I felt very gratified in the selection that we made this year.
For sure. Hey, Drew, I wondered, there's a short poem there by Dunya Mikhail that I wonder if you could read to us.
Yeah, so Dunya Mikhail is wonderful. She's one of my favorite poets of all time, actually. She's an Iraqi-American poet coming out of this incredible tradition. And her poems, to me, like just kind of remind me of like the best part of Sunday morning. They're just wonderful. So she gave us a poem called That Place, which originally appeared in her book called In Her Feminine Sign, published by New Directions. And this is That Place by Dunya Mikhail. I want that place and you in it as always. How you remember my flower kept in the refrigerator. I want that place and I in it as always. The candy moon we put under our pillows to dream of those who will love us tomorrow. I know the trees in your garden and how they grow quietly like grandmothers and how the gravity pulls light into your hands.
That's beautiful.
She's incredible. Yeah. I mean, I want to echo what Nandi said as well, that like people really brought their A game for this. And I'm very grateful for that.
What were the things that had to happen for this issue to come together? Drew, could you just sort of take us through it?
Yes, of course. So we started last year with a pandemic fiction issue where I contacted basically a number of my friends, some very excellent writers in the city, to see if they wanted to do an issue like this where they wouldn't be paid. Because at the time, the Metro Times was really struggling. We didn't know if the Metro Times was going to make it because a large part of their revenue comes from event advertising, and events had shut down abruptly. So it was a pretty scary time. And the Metro Times, for a lot of people, has been this kind of, springboard. And, you know, it's the Metro Times that tells people when our poetry readings are and when our art shows are, and publishes young writers for the first time in a lot of cases. So they're kind of essential to the art ecosystem in Detroit. So we wanted to help out. And that was a great success. It was a beautiful, lovely issue. And I sent that to the folks at Kresge, as many of their fellows were in that issue, including myself and Nandi. And they ended up paying the writers on the back end after the fact. I wrote a couple of very detailed proposals and sent it to them about doing it next year, and they agreed. And they have agreed to fund this issue for into the future, for the next couple of years at least. And then, you know, we worked with the Metro Times, and they're always, of course, happy to publish it. They like, I think the editor-in-chief there, Lita Vito, who is a great guy, told me, you know, if what's the point of having an alternative news weekly if we can't do stuff like this once in a while? But it seems to work out every year. So we're very excited to have it go into the future. But I think we've made something really incredible, and I very, very much appreciate all of the support from so many different areas of our community.
My guests today have been Nandi Comer, poet and deputy editor, and Drew Philp, writer and editor of Metro Times 2021 fiction issue. Guys, thank you so much. This is a beautiful collection.
Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate you having us on.
After a quick break, we'll revisit a conversation I had with one of the featured writers in the Metro Times Fiction and Poetry Special Edition, and that's Detroit native Tommy Blount. His poetry mines the nuances of what it means to be Black and queer in America. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Some poets can deliver you images as immediate as a freshly snapped Polaroid. Others work up something more like a meticulously composed oil painting. The Detroit-born poet Tommy Blount's writing belongs somewhere in the realm of short films. They leave devastating scenes in your head for weeks after you read them. The voices in these poems are fearless. They're not shy about human vulnerability, whether the threat is coming from a fist or from something much more intimate. Tommy Blount's recent poetry collection, Fantasia for the Man in Blue, presents the head-on collisions of one queer Black American's experiences with the mythos of white America. The book was a finalist for this year's National Book Award for Poetry, and it is a pleasure to welcome Tommy Blount with us today from his home in the metro area. Tommy, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, April, for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Can we start with a reading?
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, Fantasia for the Man in Blue is a poem that recurs several times through the collection, and I wondered if you would read the first version of it for us.
Absolutely. Fantasia for the Man in Blue. You know good and well you can't be out here in the dark morning to take in the moon, full as the bowl of light attached to this police cruiser. Like a grayed elephant shoots air through its trunk before it charges off to safety from a mouse in one of those old black and white cartoons, you shriek in a debutante's pitch, even though there are reports you are as large as an elephant. Car thefts in the area. The man in blue explains after he asks, "Where do you think you're going?" It's unusual to see your kind walking at this hour. You're an elephant, who's really just a man sweating away in a mascot's costume. You mumble an address. You fumble for an address that isn't your address, but mine. Oh, you've done it now. Don't say anything else. Let me take over this body, soften what letters will bend. I am a poet, after all. Don't worry. You'll see. He'll wish us a good morning and let us go after he bends us over the black hood.
That's amazing. And really just the point of departure for the themes that you're dealing with in as this poem recurs over the course of the collection. The threat is so front and center, the physical threat to Black protagonists and Black lives. And yet the verse is still at the same time so matter of fact about how common it is. I wanted to ask you what it was like to try to hit the balance between communicating the mundanity of the threat for Black readers, who certainly don't need to be reminded of this, and and also to the white readers who might benefit from a shock remembering it?
I guess I should answer this question this way, because I don't really think about, at least when I'm writing poems, I don't think overtly about audience in like an obvious way. So when I'm writing, I'm thinking about what serves the poem first, right? And I'm also thinking about, because this poem and many of my poems begin with some germ of biography or an event that has happened to me, I'm always trying to write towards a kind of alien self, if that makes sense. So when I'm writing, I'm drafting it so that that person that's on the page is alien to me, yet they are me, yet they, you know, they it is me, right? Mm-hmm. I am thinking about audience eventually, right? Because there's going to be some stranger who is going to come into this poem and enter into this poem, which is why I write towards that alien self, to sort of crack open the eye, which is what I, you know, always... Most of my poems are written in first person singular, but I'm always trying to figure out ways to complicate that and crack it open so that whoever comes to the poem steps into it, which is why that you comes in, right? That you, it's actually a pronoun that I use many times in the book, mm-hmm. To sort of be both implication of the reader, but yes, it's also, as creator of this, I'm also implicating myself in this, in these situations.
It's so great how it works, because using both you and I there, it kind of works as that invitation, maybe also mm-hmm. a summons to witness, while evoking mm-hmm. that very casual feeling of two friends or lovers on a walk together.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. There are several poems in the book talking about the dangers to Black people, and especially Black queer people, in the narratives of white America. There's another poem in the book called Late Show at the Americana that is in the voice of a police officer, and a white police officer who's reminiscing about a golden age of America and a golden age of American cinema. And he's kind of calling back for a time when he feels like narratives were so tightly controlled and there wasn't confusion. And it sounds like he feels like he's losing control that he's maintained. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's an interesting line between the storytelling that we do in pop culture, all the stuff we see in the movies, and how those stories mm-hmm. might be important for people who are in power. Were there stories like that that had an effect on you as a younger person?
I'm actually thinking about just growing up Black and queer in Detroit, which is, in the 80s and being a teen in the 90s there, and thinking about how conservative Detroit is. It's still, I still see it as very much, conservative, not in a sort of, political way, but I mean, moralistically, especially around, in the Black neighborhoods and Black family that I grew up in. And so I grew up closeted, right? And I often would, I think this is the same for a lot of queer people I'm hearing, that we sort of built little nests for ourselves, especially in the 80s. I remember doing this. I would just grab bits and pieces of characters from movies and storylines from movies. I remember watching Hairspray, the original Hairspray, John Waters. I was like 7 and 8. I had no business watching John Waters, but my but I grew up in a household that had cable. We had cable in, I think we got it in like 86 or something like that. But I remember watching Hairspray, John Waters, and remember identifying with Tracy Turnblad, you know, Ricky Lake as Tracy Turnblad, because she was, you know, she was wooing, you know, her, the male co-star who looked like Elvis for some reason. And so little stories like that, like latching on to them and not really seeing like Black queer people. I remember the character Kid from Kids Incorporated, who was played by the singer Rahsaan Patterson. I remember being drawn to that character.
There's a really funny and poignant poem in the book about you watching the movie Fame and falling hard for Leroy, one of the dancers.
Yes. That was going to be my next anecdote. Right. Yeah. Because I think that even though Leroy was presented as this sort of like street, you know, Black street smart kid, you know, but there was something in me that recognized, even at like eight, you know, there was something in me that recognized the queerness of him, right? And the queerness of that character. And so that character and Gene Anthony Ray, who's the actor who played him, sadly passed away, I think from complications from AIDS. Mm. But that's one character I often think about among the many constellations of figures. I call them my sort of saints that I call on.
Were the people around you recognizing what you were discovering about yourself at this time?
Oh, no. Or at least if they were, they... Well, okay, I take that back, because there was a lot... I think... Yeah, there definitely was some recognition, because there was a lot of name-calling. A lot of, you know, oh, you're Tinkerbell, or oh, you're a sissy, or, you know, you're the F-word, right? Mm-hmm. So there was some recognition that I was other. I can even remember, you know, being sort of not scolded, but teased because of the way that I talk. Because even then, you know, I was pulling from all of these different places, like, you know, film and TV. And so I'd had this like incredible for like a 9-year-old syntax or whatever that didn't sound like anyone else, you know, in the family. And so that kind of otherness, because it could not be named, or they perhaps didn't want to name it, was kind of, you know, teased. And this is like a, you know, common story, I think, with a lot of queer people. But and so my whole thing was, the way that I put it is sort of tempering the music of how I spoke and trying in order to harmonize with, you know, everyone around me, which is how I still think about music and poetry that way. It's a kind of pragmatic thing for my speakers to get them through the moment. Mm-hmm. So it's not just, you know, a melodious thing that sort of makes the sweetness that makes the bitterness go down in the poem, but it's also a pragmatic thing. Like in the poem Phonophobia in the book, where it's actually, that title is actually like a real phobia of mine, which is how it started.
Well,
but
it's like
a real phobia.
Just to explain to people, this is sort of about a conversation that you used to have with your brother about a situation that he remembered and you did not.
Right. And it's a strange little poem, but that poem is the secondary structure of that poem is all about sound and sonics, and the poem sort of grapples with finding a silence, and by the end it finds a kind of silence that we probably didn't want to find.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is poet Tommy Blount. His recently published collection of poems is called Fantasia for the Man in Blue, and it was a finalist for this year's National Book Award. There's you invoke a lot of things in the poems in this book that I don't know how this reads for people who've never been to Detroit, but there are things and places in here that Detroiters will recognize. Palmer Park, mm-hmm. the big Kehinde Wiley portrait at the Detroit Institute mm-hmm. of Arts, and mm-hmm. going through the poems, there's also this invitation to see these things which may be familiar through a lens of queerness. Mm-hmm. So first of all, thank you for that.
Oh, great.
And you talk at one point about how Palmer Park has historically been a place where queer folks go to be together before there were safe places to go, mm-hmm. and that the park itself was not always safe. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Are there things that you think are important to memorialize or to remember about a place like that?
Yes, absolutely. I think, well, first of all, thank you for noticing. I call that my ghost map in the book of Detroit. Again, it's that thing I was talking about of in a way, it's complicating the eye because I am from this place, yet I use it so that it sort of cracks open and gives the reader an entry point. But yes, I do think the older I'm getting, I'm not that old, I'm 41, but the more that I am lamenting these sort of not just queer spaces, but spaces in general, like the high school that I went to. I went to Detroit Rufford High School. It's a mire now, and then you know, the neighborhood that I grew up in does not look like the neighborhood that I left, and certainly places and queer spaces are definitely important to not just remember them, but to perpetuate their power, like to use them and to utilize them. And because history too is tied into that, and stories are also tied into those spaces. And with any lineage, you know, you want to pass that information along so that not only just things are not forgotten or places are not forgotten, but old problems that have been, you know, that had solutions, they always come back, you know, and when we know what has happened in the past, I hope that we can use that to solve what's happening in the now.
When I say your writing is fearless, I feel like I kind of know everything that looks fearless is actually a study is in figuring out how to work with fear or work around
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm.
So
yes.
I just really wanted to thank you for everything in this collection. And we're looking forward to talking with you again.
Thank you so much, April. This has been fantastic.
Tommy Blount is a poet. His latest collection, Fantasia for the Man in Blue, was a finalist for the National Book Award 2020 for poetry. It's currently available from Four Way Books. Support for arts and cultural coverage on Stateside comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Well, the team here at Stateside is taking a break on Memorial Day. Monday, you'll be hearing a special that's called We've Never Been the Same, a war story. And it's the tale of one night in battle in 1968 and the decades of recovery that followed. Please do listen in for this special program on Monday. That's Memorial Day at 3 o'clock and 9 o'clock here on Michigan Radio. You know, if you just can't wait till Tuesday to hear more Stateside, we still have you covered. Go to the place where you listen to podcasts and sign up for the Stateside podcast. Among this week's episodes, we've got our conversation about the growing population of ticks in the state. Beware, the ick factor is massive on this one. Plus, a wonderful discussion with the owner of Baobab Fair in Detroit. He's a refugee from Burundi and talks about serving up his home country's cuisine and starting a business in the middle of the pandemic. These are just a few of the conversations waiting for you on the Stateside podcast. Make sure to hit the subscribe button so that you'll get all the latest interviews every day. And that's Stateside for today. Thank you so much for listening. Have a safe weekend. I'm April Baer.